I'm going to start the lesson tonight with an apology. I used to make fun of this statement when I was younger, and yet I have to start my lesson off tonight with this particular statement. When I was a child, you know, it's that list of things your parents said that you say you'd never say. This was like right up there. With that, this and I'll give you something to cry about. Never understood that one. But I remember listening to my parents and my grandparents, and I always wondered, what kind of world did they grow up in? Surely it's not the planet where I was standing. You know, they would come up with things like, when I was a child, I like this one, I walked 20 miles to school each way uphill into the wind, and it was snowing every day. When I was a child, we got up with the sun and we went to bed with the sun and we worked all day long. Now, Harvey, I've been reading your book. When you were a child, I don't know what it was like back then, but here's one of the things. When Harvey was a child, we didn't have air conditioning. We didn't have air conditioning when I was a child either, but when I was a child, we didn't have running water. Not me, we had running water. When I was a child, we didn't even have toilet paper. Now, some of these things you may have heard. Some of the things you may not have heard. If you were saying it now, if I was looking at a young person now and I was trying to say something, I would probably say things like, when I was a child, I had to learn how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. When I was a child, I had to learn how to write cursive. When I was a child, we didn't have an internet. When I was a child, we didn't have computers. We didn't even have calculators. We had abacus, you know, and I learned how to use a slide rule. But we didn't have those things when I was a child. But the only thing I want to say tonight, when I was a child, is when I was a child, Christmas was simple. The entire country would stop for a period of time, and they would focus on the birth of a child. Some people would just focus for that day, the 25th of December. Some people would focus for, like, the whole month. And actually, some people still focus for the entire period between Thanksgiving and New Year's. And the country would just stop. It was very simple. It was not for just some child, but it was the child of God. And everybody would say that, and the country would stop. It was simple, it was beautiful, and it was Christmas. And as far as we were concerned, and as far as we knew, the whole world stopped on that day. Because it was simple, and we just didn't know any better. And then this week, I had a little jolt of reality. I was on Facebook Messenger talking to a young Romanian friend of mine, Madalina. She is doing a one-year study in Turkey. She got a scholarship to go study at the university over there. And I was just talking back and forth to her, and I asked her, so what are you going to do for Christmas? And she said, on Christmas Day, I'll be going to class. She goes, we get off the 1st of January, but that's it. December 25th. Is just another day in Turkey. Now, after I got over the initial shock, and there was some initial shock involved in this, I realized it's not a Christian nation. And, of course, I wonder if we are anymore. In years past, I remember seeing at least one or two commercials a year that would at least say, remember the reason for the season. And I don't remember the last time I've seen one of those commercials, why anyone would say that. The trend now is to wish people happy holidays. Whichever, if it's Kwanzaa, if it's Hanukkah, whatever, let's not offend anybody. Be politically correct. After all, what if they aren't Christians? And that's really the question that I want to start with tonight and probably end with. What if they're not Christians? I got to this point in my lesson when I was writing, and I said I could go like several different directions with this. And I'm going to go on one that you probably wouldn't expect. And just in case you need it, I have my own soapbox with me. So it's here, it's ready to go. And I'll come back to that question. But I want you to think for a minute, and Charlie scratched it this morning when he was talking about the birth of Christ. He at least talked about it, which so many preachers run away from. But the birth of Christ, when you think about the story, when I was a kid, when I was a child, we had pageants at churches. We had plays in the school where there would be, you know, this little manger scene up here, and there would be, you know, sometimes they even brought in live animals. You know, and that was really kind of cool. And then coming from the back of the auditorium would be three guys looking for the star, looking for the child. And even in the schools, we were able to do that when I was a child. But if you think about the story, it really starts, well, it starts in the beginning with the prophecies, and as early as we talked about this morning, probably in Genesis with the prophecy of the bruising of the heel. But you can go back and look in the New Testament, and the story begins with John the Baptist, which was also a miraculous birth that sometimes gets overlooked because we don't think of it to the level of, and it's not really to the level of the Immaculate Conception. But, you know, in all of the pageants and all the plays, they never really talked about that part of the story. Because if you got down to that part of the story, you would have had to talk about where babies come from. And back when I was a child, schools didn't talk about where babies come from. If you were lucky, your parents would talk about where babies come from, but even that wasn't a guarantee when I was a child. Go back to John the Baptist. He was born to set the stage for Jesus, to prepare the people's heart to accept the Christ. And then you have the story of the birth of Christ. Charlie got as far as the part where Joseph was told by the angel to accept her and to stay with her, and he did that. And then you have the however many wise. Every play was always three wise men. I just got to tell you that. And Charlie even mentioned that this morning. We don't know how many there were, but we knew there were three gifts: the gold, the frankincense, and the myrrh. And if you think about it, it's really kind of neat because if you were going from home to Bethlehem to Egypt, it would be nice to have a little bit of cash to make your way, or a little bit of currency that you could use. And God provided that in the gifts. And from the time Jesus was born through the exile into Egypt, but through that time they spent there, very little is known other than this one trip that Jesus took with his parents. And he went to this, they were having a census, and they all went, and of course, the part we remember the most was the fact that Jesus was left behind. Mom and Dad said, okay, we're going home, and they start walking a day later. Hey, has anybody seen little Jesus? And they all of a sudden realized he wasn't there. So they go back, they find him, he's in the temple, he's sitting there with the teachers and the priest, and they were amazed at what he knew for a young man. You know, it's almost like he knew what he was talking about. And his parents were angry, and they said, man, you just cost us 2 days, one day out, one day back, and now we're here. What are you doing? And how do you defend something when he looks at you and say, oh, yeah, I'm just taking care of my father's business? I mean, what do you say? At that point, it's like, I got nothing. I'm sure that's what Joseph said. I'm sure that's what Mary said. I have nothing. And then we have nothing else, really, until the time Jesus starts his ministry. We know that he experienced life. Of all the things he could have experienced, we know he experienced life. He got the whole package of life. He has everything that you have, everything that I have, except for one thing. And we know what that is. He did not have the sin. He had the temptations. And Hebrews said he had every temptation that we have, but he had no sin. And the other reason we know he has no sin is because there's just a few verses that mention it. 1 Peter 2:22, it said he committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. Or 2 Corinthians 5:21, for our sake he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. And if you Google it, people, you will find 10 references saying that Jesus had no sin. He was tempted in every way that we were, but he did not sin. In order to really understand Jesus, which it's neat to stop and to recognize his birth, because that had to happen, and it had to happen the way it did. But we have to really understand what happened after the birth, as much as we do the birth. And I think that's the problem. We never really had any pageants other than Christmas. We occasionally you'd have the story of Easter, and you'd have somebody reenact the crosses, but you never really had any great pageants about his teaching, about his life. And we need to understand his birth, his life, his death, and his resurrection. We have to understand the whole package. And if you think about his life, how many of us have sat there and we read the temptations? And you know, if we were tempted with what Jesus was tempted with by Satan after his 40 days of fasting, first of all, we couldn't have done any of them. It wouldn't have been a temptation for us. I could not turn a rock into bread, although after 40 days I might be tempted to eat a rock. I would not dare jump off the highest peak, and I would not dare bow down before Satan and worship him in order to rule everything that I see, because I don't really want to rule everything I see anyway. That's not a temptation for me. But he took those temptations and he walked through them at the weakest time in his life. And then you have the healing. He healed the lepers. He healed the blind. He healed the people who had never walked before. And when Jesus healed somebody, the neatest thing about it, and what I want you to understand is they didn't need physical therapy. Ben, you're out of business. When he healed somebody, they got up and walked home, or they danced on the way home, or they ran home. They did not. When Jesus healed somebody, they were truly healed. He'd drive out the evil spirits, and every one of those evil spirits that Jesus went to, as he approached the person, every one of them said, "Uh-oh, I know who you are. You're the Son of God. What do you want with me?" And every one of them, Jesus goes, "Shh. First of all, I want you to be quiet. And second, I want you to get out." And then you have the other miracles. You know, everyone's favorite, turning the water into wine. The feeding of the 5,000. The walking on the water. But my personal favorite, and if y'all may have a favorite, you may not have a favorite. My personal favorite is during the storm on the water, when Jesus just got up and said, "That's enough. Be quiet. Be still." And the winds and the waves stopped. You're beginning to understand who he is. But what really was cool was when he taught people. Whether he taught in parables or he just sat around talking to people and sharing with them and trying to explain what the kingdom of heaven was like. Jesus made contact with people. That was the whole point of what he was doing. He was trying to connect to the people. Something maybe we need to take and think about from time to time. And then he chose 12 from among all the people who he wanted to have the closest to him and to teach. And then, of course, as you read the story, you understand that of those 12 that were so close to him and he loved so much, one of them betrayed him. All part of the story, all part of what you have to understand. And then you have the mock trial. You have the lying witnesses. You have the cross. You have the burial. And you have the resurrection. And of all this, if you want to know what you need to know about that, you need to understand that there's a sacrifice that was made for you, and you do need to take it personally. But you also have to understand that the story does not end there. Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost was probably one of the most awesome speeches you can think of. I'm going to boil it down to a sentence. You had the Messiah, and you blew it. You killed him. Repent and be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins. That was probably the least politically correct sermon of all time. Because when you're coming down to it, who was he talking to? Was he talking to a group of Christians? No. He was talking to really a large part of the group who just crucified Jesus a few weeks before. And as basic as that lesson was, and a lesson doesn't have to be really all that involved, as basic as that lesson was, 3,000 people were added to the number on that day. A couple of weeks ago, and Josh has left, so I can't really make fun of him too much. But a couple of weeks ago, Josh was teaching, and he was up here on Saturday night, and he was teaching from the book of Acts. And one of his points that night was on the stoning of Stephen in chapter 7. And Stephen's speech was, let's say, stirring. It brought out certain emotions in certain people. It was not politically correct. And anytime you lead with, you group of stiff-necked people, you know, if you think that's productive, read the 23rd chapter of Matthew. You vipers, you hypocrites. Jesus knew his time was close, and so he just went ahead and said what he thought too. Stephen pretty much knew his time was there at that point of his speech. And so he basically said, you stiff-necked people. But he was not speaking to Christians. The very first verse in chapter 8, the book of Acts, it says, and Saul approved of the execution. Now, I have to tell you, I'm sitting here thinking, and I had this discussion with a group of Romanians last week. Was Saul a bad man? And I would ask for a show of hands, but I'm not going to do that to you. He was an enemy of the church that Christ had established, obviously. He was zealous in his defense of the Jewish faith and all the Jewish traditions, obviously. He prosecuted and persecuted Christians wherever and whenever he could. Does that make him a bad person? I'd have to say no. Saul is doing the best he can with what he knew at that time. He was zealously serving a God that he loved in a way he thought God wanted him to. And it was not until he had a direct revelation from Jesus himself that he understood the error of his ways. And one thing I have developed over the years is even a certain level of admiration for those who are that committed. Even if I don't agree with their theology, they're committed. Last summer, I was driving through the neighborhood, and I stopped to help a couple of the Mormon elders with a bicycle problem. It was a fun conversation. I don't know that anybody accomplished anything. And they are really nice young men. Are they bad people? Many years ago, when I was in the Army, I remember a Mormon family that Ann and I knew, and they invited us to a gathering at their home one night. And, okay, once we figured out we were being recruited, it was a little bit awkward. And I also remember, though, that it was probably one of the nicest group of people we had ever been in a room with. Every family there was just awesome. And if we had not had a firm enough base to start with, if we were looking for something to hold on to, I could see how you could hold on to that if you didn't know anything else. Now, I want to challenge you now to think a little bit deeper. And this is probably where my soapbox is coming in. In Mickey's class this morning, we touched on something, and we kind of, I bit my tongue because I was going to save it for tonight, Mickey. But what about the Muslims? What about the radicals out there? Are they bad people? They're attacking anyone who's not one of them. And it's not even just the U.S. anymore. It's They've just declared war on the world. I'm not going to get political here because this really isn't a political issue. It's a religious issue. Are they bad people? And my answer would be the same. I personally, if you want to put it into terms, let's say Paul was a first century terrorist. Probably didn't think of it like that. But he was only a terrorist until somebody taught him better. Just like Saul, the people we're talking about now are willing to go to whatever lengths they need to go to serve their God. Are we that committed? And I can tell you the answer is no. So we don't even try to answer that, which brings me back to the question that I started with earlier. It's a very simple question. What if they are not Christians? Well, whose fault would that be? Probably mine and yours. About the only person that we could not blame is God himself. Because God's given us everything we need. And then after he gave us everything we needed, he gave us instructions to go use it. Instead, we have a tendency to look through our eyes at the rest of the world, through our Christian eyes with our Christian judgment. And we are told specifically, by the way, not to do that. In 1 Corinthians 5, 12 and 13, simple verse, "For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Is it not those inside the church whom you are to judge? God judges those outside, so purge the evil from among you." So I ask the question again, are they bad people? And the answer is that's really not even ours to judge. We tend to look at the world through our Christian view, and we can't do that. And the example I like to use, and some of you may think, oh no, now he's really going over the edge. Let's say I am traveling through a part of the country where there are cannibals. How do you handle that? Well, let me tell you what you don't do. You don't walk in at dinner time and say, "Hey, you shouldn't eat people." Because you're putting your values on these people. And unless you're a really fast talker, you're going to be either named breakfast or lunch. You may never get the chance to explain why if you start with that as an approach. But if you want to change who or what they eat, you have to change them at a deeper level. You have to change who they are, or probably more important, whose they are. Introduce them to God. Not any God, because they probably have one or two of those, but the one true God and his son Jesus. Now, here's a question I want to ask you, and I want you to kind of squirm a little bit and think about it. Would it motivate you any more if you weren't able to convert somebody, they would eat you? Would it make you try harder? That's kind of the point where the world is getting today, in all honesty. It's kind of a convert or be eaten, or convert or either teach them and convert them, or just prepare to be blown up someday. But the option's there. The violence and the attacks are coming at a time in our country where the church is probably on the ropes. We are considered weak. We are considered lifeless. And they're just sitting there sharpening their knives, getting ready to eat. That's all they're doing. And we are being pushed more and more into the background, and we're letting it happen. One nation under God is gone. And we let it happen on our watch. Now, the order came from the top, in all honesty. I remember about 7 years ago when I was watching television, and I remember hearing it saying, "We are no longer a nation under God. We are now a nation of the people." And my first response was, "Oh boy, we're lost." Go back and look and just see how far, how fast this nation has gone down since we quit looking at God. And remember Proverbs 14:12, where it simply says, there's a way that seems right for a man, but in the end leads to death. Now, there is still a way to get back. That's the good news. There's only one way, really, to get back. It's pretty simple. It's one soul at a time, one study at a time, one godly act at a time. And we cannot wait for someone else to do that, because I've checked the attendance rolls here, and someone else has retired, grown a beard, and moved away. They no longer go here. Someone else will never pick up the torch and run with it. I appreciated Charlie this morning. He didn't run from Christmas. So many preachers do and have. And then they always have the disclaimer that, yeah, this isn't the time of year. But hey, man, it is a time when we have everybody's attention. And if we have everybody's attention, I say use it. Take advantage of it. It wasn't a traditional sermon, Christmas sermon this morning, Charlie, but here's all I really have to say. Not happy holidays, Merry Christmas. Use this time to celebrate Christ. And if you happen to offend somebody along the way, and if they happen to say something to you about it, amen, go for it. Use that as an open door to explain the whole story of Jesus Christ. Seize the day. But don't stop at the manger. Don't even stop at the cross. But explain the church. Explain the mission that Jesus gave us when he left. The story may begin in Genesis, but it doesn't end till Christ comes back. And that's the part we need to remember. The story is still being written. And we get to choose how our nation and how the world at this time will be viewed in the course of the history of the world. Now, I'm personally voting that we are still a nation that's willing to follow God. And the only way we get back to that is to become active, vocal, and evangelistic. Being a bold people, spreading the good news throughout the world. And the world starts here.